This is the Art of Darkness podcast with Kevin Kautzman
and Brad Kelly. We're a couple of very online writers interested in the dark side of what drives creative people to create against all odds.
This show is about art and the people who make it, what it costs them, and what it takes to bring something unique and impactful into the world.
Each episode, we excavate the life and work of an artist you might think you know.
Don't worry, they're all safely dead.
On every episode, we try and find out just what the hell was wrong with them and how they worked through their darkness to create something that lives on after them and continues to move culture.
Find us online at artofdarkpod.com and on Twitter at artofdarkpod.
Are back in the dark room for another scintillating conversation. For folks who have not checked out a dark room episode before, how this works is we have already done an in-depth four episode detailing the life and work of a great creative figure, in this case, Bill Hicks. And in the dark room, we bring in somebody who maybe knows that subject a little better, knows them a little bit differently, has something interesting to say about that subject and maybe other interesting things to say as well. And we further develop our thinking about this character. That's the whole dark room shtick, right? Mm. So, first of all, I'm Brad Kelly. This is Kevin Kautzman, my co-host. And we are presenting to you today a conversation with the magnetic memory master, author, writer, YouTuber extraordinaire,
publisher,
Anthony Metivier. He is the founder of the Magnetic Memory Method, which is a systematic approach to memorizing just about anything or everything. He has a PhD from York University, and is the author of more books than I can count, including one that I'm going to get into here. I'm going to read this one. I wish I had already read it. The Victorious Mind, How to Master Memory, Meditation, and Mental Well-Being, as Flyboy, a book I have right here, which is maybe I'll have Anthony describe it in a minute, but it's a murder mystery that in which memory techniques are used by the detective. Mm. And I can imagine not only a detective making good use of memory techniques, but anybody up to and including someone like Bill Hicks. So, Anthony, how are you? Thank you for joining us. We really appreciate your time.
Oh, I'm having a blast. It's the wildest adventure this world. Oh, and excellent. Thank you for having me, and thank you for that introduction. Really appreciate it.
Good. Yeah. This is exciting. It's interesting. You and I connected a while back and through the magic of the internet. And then, when I came on your show, there were some people in our audience that were like, oh, you're going on, like, they were kind of surprised of that connection, I suppose. And then when this was coming up, there were some other people who were like, oh, that's an interesting crossover. Not necessarily, in the same niche, I don't think, but it's cool to talk to you and get to know you. So I'm really looking forward to having this conversation.
I'm always surprised by the surprise,
right?
Because the thing that I work on is consciousness, ultimately, right? Like, it's memory, but memory is really the engine or the series of engines that, if we're going to be in science material world for a while here,
sure.
The question is, and I don't know the answer, but is memory nested in consciousness or is consciousness nested in memory? And since we have things like brain scans, and probably none of us is like so clever to have invented such a thing as brain scans in our imagination, like, it probably is real that you could scan the brain and then you could derive, well, there's procedural memory, there's episodic memory, there's figural memory, there's like all this stuff. And so consciousness is probably nested in those engines that are just, and they're producing this. So then when people say, well, that's a weird, unexpected crossover, I'm like, really? We're trying to have like everything in this one space of consciousness.
Right, you know? Right.
Like, of course, everything should cross over because that would be the ultimate experience of consciousness, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Are you sure we're talking about Bill Hicks? I feel like we should be talking about Borges here.
I was going to mention to you guys something if certain themes came up, because that's the crossover principle, right? Mm-hmm. Like Borges and Hicks go together, Poe and Hicks go together, Hesse and Hicks go together. Like many of the people that I've heard you talk about and admired your conversations with, these are tethered at the hip, I think, a little tighter than it may seem at first glance.
Yeah, I think, you know, when Kevin and I started the show, we sort of knew that. And then as we're developing episodes, it's just like, oh, so, you know, everybody, the joke that we turn it into, because sometimes the easiest way to see the connections is these direct relationships, like so-and-so knew this other person, right? Or was directly influenced by them. But we start to do this show and you're like, oh, all these people are basically, they're basically in the same, they're practically in the same room.
The glass bead game. The podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
Is somewhat what we're doing.
Yeah, definitely. I want to, you know, on the Bill Hicks thing, you know, we got kind of talking, obviously people will know there's back channel conversations that lead to these conversations we record. And I kind of threw it out there, Anthony, anybody you want to talk about, let's do it. And you brought up Bill Hicks, and I'm not going to say I was surprised, but it got me curious thinking, huh, I wonder why Bill Hicks, what is the connection? What does he mean to you, Anthony?
Oh, he means so many things. And part of my attraction to it is the real tension between rationality, logic, critical thinking, criticism, which sometimes isn't that critical, but anyway, you know, this real brutal, this is reality. It could be a lot better if it was this way, just crashing up against spirituality, the complete sense of wholeness. And really, I think that there's a true comedy to the way that he did it. Yeah. Which it makes it like a super genre in my mind. So, you know, there's genres, and then there's genres that just transcend genre-ness because they kind of have all the genres in them. Or maybe another way to say it is there are stories that are so aligned to the Oedipal matrix, let's say, or the Oedipal architectonic tautology, if I can whip out one of those fun words that I memorized once upon a time. They're like so woven to that they explode out of themselves. And that's what I think Hicks was doing. And I think that he knew that he was doing it. And I think that maybe the Hellraiser moment where, you know, his suffering was legendary, even in hell.
Interesting.
I should laugh though.
Yeah, well, he would laugh, I think, right? I think that's such an interesting point. And it actually relates to something else that I, you know, Bill Hicks stands as the sort of like Generation X figure. Like when I think on, you know, I think about in the whole discourse about the differences between the generations is really... most of the time, it's not particularly useful, but I do think there are sort of landmarks. And when I think of like who is a sort of in like Western culture, who is a you know, emblematic figure of Generation X, I think of Bill Hicks amongst, you know, a handful of others.
That Gen X, I tell you what, they really wanted their MTV.
They did. They did.
They got it. They got their MTV good and hard.
They did. I miss it. See, I'm sort of an honorary Generation X person. But you know, in kind of what you're saying, Anthony, you know, he's sort of transcending this thing. I think when you do sort of transcend your genre, and you bring, it's not even necessarily that you bring new ideas. It's you kind of articulate what's already being thought about by people, which I think is something that Bill Hicks was really good at doing. And, you know, I think now you look back at some of the material and it can, if you're not thinking about it carefully, or if you're thinking about it too critically, some of it can feel a little dated. And I realize that the only reason it feels dated is because half of the world sort of thinks like him now. And at the time, that wasn't necessarily the case. And it's partially we think like that because of him. And so it's one of those cases where it's like, oh, that's old hat. And it's like, it wasn't old hat when he said it. You know, that stuff was that he was blowing people's minds. So like, when did you can you remember like when you first kind of came into contact with him?
Yeah, I think I can. Memory is a twisty thing. So apparently all the time, when you recall memories, you actually transform them. But my initial memory is in a parking lot in front of my high school and opening up the CD tray of the Tool album, just being like, who is this guy? And they're like, well, you don't know who Bill Hicks is. And it's just like, let me educate you. Mm-hmm. And so that was the kind of thing that I remember first encountering him, which I think is very, very common. And there was no internet really. So that was how legend spread, was through moments like that. But I don't think in Canada where I grew up.
Yeah. Well, that album was the internet for a year. Yeah,
yes.
Right.
Where I grew up in Canada, like we had 13 channels on TV, I think at that time. Rare was the person who had satellite. So, you know, sometimes I'd be invited over to some friend who had HBO or whatever.
And, sure. So right. The maple syrup channel, the hockey channel, the Tim Hortons channel. Okay.
Exactly like that.
The Red Green Show marathon, you know, that.
Hey, Red Green Show.
Hey, you know, I'm not, listen.
I love the Red Green Show.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm. I grew up close to Canada. So we got the Red Green Show. We got all the Canadian TV over here. So, Hey, well, this brings up an interesting question. So I don't remember how I came across Bill Hicks first, to be honest. I couldn't tell you. It sort of just always existed for me. I don't know. Would you have owned the specials on VHS? Like, how did that? This seems like a very.
It went around on CD and VHS. Okay. I mean, I think the majority of people got turned on to him by Tool for sure. Yeah, I mean, that album won a Grammy, and that's the album where they kind of blew the roof off. And they put him on the album. And we're going to talk about Tool's relationship with Bill Hicks on the After Dark for Patreon and Substack, patreon.com/artofdarkpod. I'm excited about that. Yeah, I'm the same way, Anthony. That's exactly how I got turned on to him. And it didn't quite land for me right away. Like, I'm like, what is this? Why am I listening to this progressive metal? Who is this man talking about the Beatles and drugs? And, you know, I'm like 14, 15, you know, I'm like, what is this? And then a few years later, I was reciting whole bits, just kind of obsessed. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a pretty common experience. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. I think it was really Napster the Napster era, where then he was really all over the place. And, you know, on the same day, you're downloading Self-Help en masse and Bill Hicks. And there's almost like no distinction between the two in some sense, you know, and you could expand your own consciousness by seeing them in the same sort of light. At least that was my experience.
Interesting. Tell me about that. Like, tell me about that a little bit more. So, because Bill Hicks, tell me about that. So if someone were to, is there something we can take from Bill Hicks in terms of like how to live our own lives? Is that kind of what you're suggesting? Or
I think so. I mean, that's what art is, right? Art is an instruction manual for almost how not to live. So much of this pain is coming out and it's creating these little signposts that basically say, this is why I'm suffering. Mm-hmm. Don't do these things, and then maybe you'll be able to avoid it. So, you know, there's that book, Agent of Evolution, about Bill Hicks, that, you know, they go back and forth about his hatred of marketing, but then yet he was not stupid. Like, he knew the importance of marketing, and it wasn't that he wanted to be poor or anything like that. But there's that inability to reckon with it that comes into the art, right? Like, it's mentioned in that book, like he really did hate Tiffany. That's not acting, but it's not like he wasn't aware that part of that hatred was his wish to be Tiffany level through the
right there, there's
through the mechanisms of entertainment, you know, mass media. So the lesson in there is like he's telling you these things, and he ends, at least for a period of his career, and this is where I think it's like real comedy, he ends with this true, genuine love, everybody, you know, bring it all back to the oneness. And why I think of that as true comedy, I don't think he's faking it, but that's what comedy is. It's the return to the unification of society. You know, you can have all this turmoil, all this conflict, etc., but there's a symbolic marriage, and he's symbolically marrying himself to you through this. So,
and
are
you
going to notice
I'm
that
sorry,
and
is laughter,
start thinking?
Go, is laughter a part? Is laughter a necessary condition for that? Do you think?
Well, I mean, there's all kinds of laughter. There's not to get all intellectually noodly about what laughter.
No, we love the intellectual.
I don't know if
laughter
is.
Noodly.
I don't know if laughter must have, you know, a belly jowl sort of thing where you're shaking and blurting out all sorts of things. There's, I mean, this would be the kind of spiritual component of sound and like all the sound poetry he used to do, you know. I will not try to imitate it because it will not be good. But, you know, just imitating Hendrix's guitar and like all that sort of stuff. This goes into your brain and it helps resonate it. And that's a kind of, I think, thing that's so similar to laughter that if you're not transformed by that at a psychophysical level, I don't know, you're not even not paying attention.
Well, and you know who would relate to this is I feel like we're at a level of kind of Gurdjieffian thinking here, right? You can, you can adjust people's octagonal resonance, right? You know, they're down here and I want to bring them here. And laughter, I think, is a sure sign of it. Nobody if you laugh voluntarily, it's creepy. It's involuntary. Yeah. And very, very strange laughter. I'm sure there's a lot of science and thinking around it, but I love what you're saying. I'm totally resonating here because it's like he's part preacher, part therapist, part scapegoat. He's like taking on your sins somehow. You know, I mean, a lot of people kind of soured on him over time because like, I don't want to listen to this guy. He's too preachy, And like, okay, all right. But I mean, when you think about the American style, and the American mode of the 90s, I mean, he was doing like a preacher. And you know, you could turn the TV on in the 90s and the TV preachers were everywhere. That was like, this man was from Texas. You know, he was a product.
I don't think he's any more or less preachier than George Carlin or something like that.
No.
Totally agree.
I think he's just a little bit more nailed on the truth of things than Carlin. Quite frankly.
Go ahead.
I think Carlin's an interesting point, though, to make a comparison and contrast, because I heard Carlin in an interview one time, and Carlin said that he really never – I didn't memorize what he said, so I may have missed the exact wording here, or even maybe just reshaping it to my own thing. What is it in Lost Highway? Sometimes I like to remember things the way I remember them, not necessarily the way they happened. Anyway, it was something with Carlin where he was saying like he never really – could love the audience until that he let go of trying to transform them. He is preachy. Like he has a political edge and his edge is he knows his bias and it causes him suffering. But the point of him saying, when I finally let go of the idea that I was ever going to change anybody, then I was in the zone. I was able to be a better comedian. And I think that actually Bill Hicks never could let that go. I mean, I have that impression that he really thought that you could change things. And that was part of what that was so fascinating to me of the conflict in his own conflict with enlightenment, because the full enlightenment really would be letting go of the idea that you could transform things because you're not separate from it. It is in fact causing you to be the way that you are more than you could ever cause yourself to be a particular way.
Yeah.
Well, they talk about laughter being medicine, right? And you talk about the Tool album Anima, and I don't know if anybody has a copy of the CD, if that still goes around, but of course, famously, the CD had you know, the insert with Bill Hicks pulling Maynard's leg and the sort of braces coming off Maynard's leg, Maynard laughing, and then he had his third eye, kind of weird, you know, Cthulhu hat, head, you know, third eye thing. And it was, you know, Bill Hicks, another dead hero, and Hicks was dressed up as a doctor. So the implication being, right, that these are medicine. This is medicine. And of course, you know, the great song Anima, I'll See You Down in Arizona Bay. I mean, explicitly riffing on a Bill Hicks bit. So they made him immortal. He was already immortal on his own terms. But and then, of course, he had his breakout success in the UK. It's so ridiculous. If he had lived another 10 years, like, he would have been a household name everywhere. He slowly, eventually kind of became that. But yeah. And so we end this story with kind of a tragic early death, too.
Can I read something that's a little bit on this?
Do it.
From, there's a book called Love the People, and it's sort of just a throw together thing of all this sort of Bill Hicks, or like there's transcripts of some. Oh, you have it?
Do you need me to grab it?
No, I got the part I want right in front of me, but yeah, that's great that you've got it.
I gotta say, of all the guests we've had, and you can see us all on YouTube if you dare.
Yeah.
YouTube.com/@artofdarkpod. I have to say, Anthony's the first guest who's come on the pod who's fully surrounded by books. His entire background is books from frame to frame. And I gotta say, I love it. I'm so happy. And by the way, and they're not color coded. It's a very natural bookshelf.
Oh, man, the color coded bookshelf, that is something.
Yeah, you gotta watch that.
No, I've never seen a color coded bookshelf.
No, it's like an Instagram. It's like an Instagram thing.
Yeah, it's
Instagram.
Yeah.
Go on. Now I understand.
Yeah, the yellow ones go here, and the orange ones go here, and there's no, you know,
really.
So let me just read this. So this book, Love All the People, it kind of just collects a bunch of different Bill Hicks stuff. And one part of it is some letters that he wrote in response to, I don't even necessarily want to say they're fans or critics, because we don't get the letters that were written to Bill. So it's hard to tell exactly what these people were or what they wanted, but he's responding to some criticism that's in their letters. So let's read this, a part of this quote. This is Bill Hicks writing to him, and I'm not going to try to impersonate him, but this doesn't exist in audio. So, quote, "You ended your piece on me with the single most baffling sentiment I have ever heard expressed regarding a comic. Quote, how are we to ever know if Mr. Hicks is prophetic or merely a crackpot? Crackpot? Surely my show didn't remind you of Professor Irwin Corey's. Since when in history of comedy reviewing has any comic ever been held up to such remarkable standards? A prophet? A crackpot? Holy shit. Think about it, Larry. If you were willing to hold me up to such an unbelievable standard such as profit, or willing to dismiss me as some kind of crackpot, surely you understand my desire for you to reassess exactly what it is I do. And I think you are right when you said we might both learn something from each other with further dialogue. Apparently it is not clear to a lot of people what it is I do. So you know what? I'm just going to come out and tell you. No beating around the bush. Okay, here goes. I, like all artists in Western cultures, am a shaman. There, now you have it. I am a shaman come in the guise of a comic in order to heal perception by using stories and jokes, and always, always, always the voice of reason, that people may have hope and peace by healing their misperceptions. I am a shaman, and my goal is to, drumroll, be myself. And the effort that takes is, another drumroll please, none. And my message is, drumroll, then cymbal crashes, be yourself. I am a shaman, a healer, and truth is my medicine. Laughter makes the bitter swallowing of truth for some a little easier." So that's fitting in, right, you know, kind of what you're talking about. I do like him bringing in this notion of the shaman. That's like a positive trigger word for me. And it does, you know, him saying that, and Anthony, the way you're describing this, it does make me kind of cast back into my thinking about him sort of searching for bits that he did that I think fit this sort of the best, you know, because some stuff doesn't obviously fit into this, right? The Randy Pan, the goat boy, I'm not sure how I fit it into the shamanic thing, but maybe I'm wrong.
Sexual repression. He's trying to get all the way down into your root chakra there. And he genuinely is trying to get the biggest, nastiest laugh that he can out of you. And he knows what the audience is too. The audience has had a few pops. It's almost always a date night. He's in Texas. He's trying to get these people who are like have a stick in their ass, frankly, and have come to laugh. If they're there, they're open to it. It's they've given permission and they've paid. David Mamet talks about this, that the audience has to pay because the audience is paying for permission to laugh. They're paying for permission to stare at you. They're paying for permission to break the social rules in this weird environment. In the case of the theater, they're paying for permission to make believe together as adults. I'm not trying to hijack it, but I've thought a lot about Bill Hicks and what he was doing. I mean, I watched that one special, the one from the one Austin special, Sane Man. I had that on VHS, man. And I must have watched that 20 times.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
I think an interesting question to ask about all this is Zen an invention of humans, or did Zen evolve spontaneously and then become metacognized?
Interesting.
Right? Yeah. So if you're all of a sudden going to be like, meh, and then, it's just like, it then creates this effect, and it like wakes people up, and you're calling them the sheeple and you're absolutely deriding them for owning a Debbie Gibson album or something like that. Right. And then you start to notice that, oh, wow, this gets attention, right?
Mm.
Well, that is effectively Zen. That's the Zen master walking around, beating the stick. Like, it's slapstick, but it's wake up. This is what's happening around you. You don't really like Debbie Gibson. It's been shoved down your throat because you also have a shopping mall shoved down your throat, because you also have cars shoved down your throat, because you also have mortgages shoved down your throat, because now I'm doing what I said I wouldn't do, which is trying to
that's like, all right, that's
sound poetry, but and I can't do it, by the way. But that's the thing, is like, does that evolve spontaneously, or is it somehow a strategic Zen move to wake up the audience? In the same way that I would ask that of Zen itself. Like, did really some master sit there one day and say, I will say crazy, unexpected stuff in order to get you to pay attention to the present moment? Or did he notice that he just suddenly did that? And then the metacognition comes in, and then a school builds around it. And that's what Bill Hicks said at one point. He was like, I studied philosophy at university. Now I'm starting to design my own belief. That was one of his lines.
And you're so right. There is a Cohen like quality to a lot of this. Like, the one thing that I think about all the time is his whole the whole bit he has about, if you work in marketing, kill yourself. And I mean, there is a way in which, like, if you've heard that and then you get a marketing job, it doesn't mean you're going to follow his suggestion. But if you've heard that, it has to come to mind occasionally. That time when you hit that button on your computer that sends out the thing, you're like, I don't know.
He's going for the anti-marketing dollar. That's a good dollar. Yeah. That's a big dollar.
He plays out the whole, like, the whole, metacognitive thought process behind that. And I feel like it makes a billion people hesitate slightly to hit that button. Very, very interesting. Yeah. So tell me, like, I followed totally what you're talking about, but now I'm curious, Anthony, when you say Zen, what do you mean exactly?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I always, maybe that's always have these things that we take for granted, and then someone calls you on it.
I don't mean to call you on it, but it is interesting because I want to make sure.
I think Zen is almost the same word as enlightenment. And so then what is enlightenment? And or it is, at least Zen is a means of achieving enlightenment. And enlightenment is essentially, well, there's different ways that I think about this. And one of the ways is something I heard James Schwartz say. And James Schwartz is amazing, if you don't know this guy.
I don't know it, no.
He wrote The Essence of Enlightenment, and he wrote Mystic by Default. Anyway, he's a quite old fellow now. And he wound up in India at one point, and he memorized or he learned Sanskrit. And basically he came to understand a particular school of philosophy called Advaita Vedanta. I believe Advaita Vedanta precedes Chan, and Chan, I believe, precedes Zen. And basically what it is it's formulas that you memorize that help dissolve or neutralize your mind, your thoughts. And so if you dissolve and neutralize your thoughts, then what ends up happening is you begin to realize that you're not separate from reality. So the ego function and like all this la-di-da stuff that Bill Hicks was kind of exposing, right? Is like, oh, you think that you know, like your corporate job or whatever, right? But really it's a trap that, and you don't even know how you got into the trap because guess what? There is no you, right? And then that's why it always sort of like ends on this love and symbolic marriage, I would call it, way of closing a set, because you're not responsible. You know, this is the free will question that I was taking pains to joke about, because I think it's hilarious that people put so much effort which clearly is outside of their will. The effort that they put into asserting that there is free will is itself the evidence that there is no free will, because I use that word evidence very, very carefully. I'm not saying it's proof. I don't actually think there is such a thing as, oh, this scientist proved something. At best, well,
especially when it comes to consciousness, I feel like proving something is this not even the right word.
It's problematic at best, and it gets into, man, that guy sounds mighty arrogant. But at the end of the day, I don't ever mean to sound arrogant about these things, because I ultimately don't know the answer to the questions. I'm more like a pauper falsifiability totalist or whatever, right?
Okay.
Like Popper was great. He said, if you're going to practice falsifiability, you damn well better falsify falsifiability itself.
Yeah.
Right?
Well,
a lot of people miss that sentence. They miss that part. But anyway, that is what enlightenment and Zen is. It is total radical metacognition falsification of everything. Everything. Like you just, nothing escapes that. And I know it, I think, reasonably well, because if you want to get bored really fast, I can recite Sanskrit for about an hour because I've memorized a bunch of this stuff. And I can tell you anecdotally, it blows your mind right out of your head. And then you just sit there and you're like, oh my God, I am one with the universe. And if you rock back and forth,
The act of reciting it does.
Well, a lot of things do.
Sure.
But it's a lot of Zen koans. They're older and they're in Sanskrit rather than in like Japanese or even Sanskrit that has been changed by some of the Buddhist and Zen traditions in translation in various ways. But it's kind of easiest to describe them by just translating some of them if you're interested.
I might want to hear one. I know koans tend to be kind of pithy, right? I mean,
yes. But my favorite really is that's the thing. I laugh because they're not pithy, because if you really take them serious, you'll spend your life on them, you know?
I didn't mean to demean them. I just meant that they're sort of...
No, I don't mean that you meant to, but...
They're like jokes in a way, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
They are. So chittameva mahadosham, chittamevahi balakaha, chittameva mahatmayam, chittameva mahanasat, chittamevahi mithya atma, chittam shashavishanavat, chittam nasti sada satyam, chittavandya kumaravat. No more unless you request it. But basically what that's saying is, mind is like an undisciplined little boy. A real thought is as rare as a rabbit with horns. There's a little bit more going on in there, but those are sort of the punchlines.
Interesting. Huh.
And yeah, I memorized a lot of that stuff, and I've recited it daily since 2017. And there's really four pieces in total, and they really mess with your system. And I mentioned the rocking back and forth because this is shown in studies that if you do this while you're chanting, it plays around with what's called the orientation association area of the brain, which also messes around with what's called the task positive network. It knocks you out of what's called the default mode network. And so you're more here. And when you mess with the orientation association area of the brain, that's when you start to feel one with all of the universe, because your brain can't locate you anymore properly. So it locates you everywhere.
right.
I love the level that you're on. Which is maybe enlightenment. I love the way that you're thinking, that you think, Anthony. Like I believe that Art of Darkness, and people, you know, some, this may rub certain people the wrong way. And I know from Mr. Beast, we're not supposed to have personalities as we make content. I read that on Twitter. If I want to make $100,000 an ad, right, exactly. But yeah. I really believe that what we do on the core episodes of Art of Darkness is a kind of seance. I feel like we're doing a kind of summoning of the spirit of the departed on this show. I believe that. I think that we're doing like kind of the contemporary equivalent of a seance. And who knows how many thousands of people over the course of the life of a single episode will hear it and through us in Salah, God willing, you know, feel or even truly come to know better a figure like Bill Hicks, somebody like Dante Alighieri. Imagine, I mean, you know, Bill's long gone, but we keep his name on our lips. We keep thinking about him, and there's something powerful about that. What do you think about the seance thing, Brad?
Well, yeah, no, I definitely think that's true. I mean, I think part of the reason that, you know, part of the reason it gets interesting to speak about a specific person is because it allows us to take it in unusual directions. I mean, I don't know that a person who hasn't spent some time thinking about it might understand how a conversation about Bill Hicks ends up talking about Zen. But everything is sort of connected. And so sometimes by focusing on a particular person who has sort of transcended the bounds of what the average person might be by creating something great. And I mean, we're pretty serious about creative production, about creativity, right? And it's the whole reason we kind of do this show. There is something about it that is that thing you're talking about, moving, you know, doing this movement and changing your orientation, changing your relationship to like the universe or whatever. All creativity does that to a certain extent. So when we talk about a specific person, it's like that's an example of how you might do that, right? In this person, you know, sometimes, and that doesn't mean that Bill Hicks is perfect. That doesn't mean that he's somebody who you should try to live your life like or anything like that. It's sort of an example about how can you survive, like spiritually, existentially, psychologically.
I'm glad you put it that way with this perfect thing, because I lost my thing. I went off on a tangent and I got away from James Schwartz. Because James Schwartz, I think his definition of enlightenment is the best. He says, basically, if you're alive and you're awake and you're having this conversation, you're enlightened. It's just the meat tube that keeps getting in the way, right? And he's like, and as long as you have a meat tube, you're going to have a battle against your own awareness of your complete and total enlightenment. Everybody's enlightened. And I always just thought that's amazing, because he also talks about just, you know, everything being a zero sum game, right? And then to tie this to Hicks, I love this idea, Kevin, of the seance, because effectively, when we read a thing or we hear a thing, it changes us. From a memory science perspective, you are literally engaged in neurogenesis, the production of new brain cells. And then these move around in your brain and they relocate, they become you. And so, you know, at the end of Agent of Evolution, they talk about how they think Bill is still somewhere doing Bill Hicks work, right? And that's absolutely true. No matter what you believe, the fact that we can riff on these things, we can share how he touched us, transformed us, or we are being the thing that we're talking about. There's no other conclusion, because it's consciousness in these chemical baths that's just sharing a limited set of alphabetical letters that are infinitely expressible. This is what Spinoza was talking about, I believe. I mean, I'm not a Spinozist, but I think Spinoza was basically saying what James Schwartz is saying. There's this meat tube here, and then it's just obscuring the truth, so to speak. But the truth is just constant new ways of combining a limited set. So maybe it's not the alphabet, but a limited set of things that just constantly combines, and it passes through the meat tube. Some of it stays in the meat tube. Some of it recurses back into the meat tube later through connections and aha moments and all that sort of stuff. But at the end of the day, it's like sediment collecting in a thing. And then, you know, you can share, you can trade some of those clamshells. You can kill yourself because you're marketing Bill Hicks to the future.
Sure. I mean, right. And, you know, and let's be fair too. The meat tube could be a pretty great place. There's a lot of fun to be had in the meat tube.
That's Aleister Crowley 101. Enjoy the meat tube.
Yeah, you might as well. You're in it, right? I mean, yeah. Well, and I think that you think about like what Bill Hicks is talking about with the ride. part of the ride is, well, you're in a meat tube for a little while, and there's, you know, there are aspects to that part of the ride. It goes up and it goes down, it goes round and round and round, right? Yeah, this is fascinating. This isn't exactly where I expected this to go, but I'm quite enjoying this conversation. I do want to, Anthony, and I don't want to get like stuck in what I call the not I call what I've adopted as a term of the object level, but I am curious, how do you think, you know, Bill Hicks died quite young. He's one of the few subjects we've covered who, if he'd lived a normal length life, he'd still be around, right? And so it's not impossible to think, okay, what would he be up to? Do you have a sense of like how this, based on the trajectory he was going and the trajectory that sort of society and culture was going, do you have any sense of what he might be doing now, like how he would interact with this?
I've been thinking about that a lot, actually, because in one of my planned memory detective novels, I have thought a lot about using Hicks as a reference point but place him now, basically, because part of what I'm doing in the larger scope of the memory detective series is like showing society in decline. So your memory has to get stronger and stronger and stronger because technology is really destroying human memory. And then I'm just thinking, and especially reviewing Hicks for this project and for our conversation today, it's just like, it actually terrifies me to think, you know, would he, especially given the way that technology has warped the political discourse right now, like where exactly would he fall? And I don't know the answer to that question. I don't want to answer that question directly, but I want to create an image that maybe interesting as a point of reflection. I'm thinking of Bill Maher squirming the way that he does, because he can't for whatever reason land on one position, right? You feel a truth bubbling behind there. You feel like an explosion waiting to happen. Like there's something so obvious that needs to be said about the disaster of the status quo right now, right? But you're almost at that level. You're just super punished for even projecting that you might have an original thought to this, right?
Right.
And he's just, so I hate to think of Hicks squirming, but at the same time, part of why that we're in this situation is because he was so damn progressive. So it's like,
Yeah.
No, not that I'm trying to out myself as not being progressive. Please, robots,
right,
please.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Wait till the algorithm gets a hold of this.
Oh, yeah.
I'm
and of course
guy
it's
who's
just
trying to like enlighten myself so everything appears in me and I don't really settle on any of them because I'm squirming too, like Bill Maher.
Right. Well,
and I just
hate to
imagine Hicks squirming, but I have a feeling he would maybe have to squirm, and that sucks.
I think we all do kind of have to squirm a little bit now. and part of it is because, well, part of it is just because things are so unstable. Kevin's got something to say, though. He's bubbling up right now.
No, you know? It's just so difficult because whatever, even the counterculture got us here. The whole culture got us here, including the counterculture. And so everybody's extraordinarily confused. Right. That thing happened where capital became a hegemony and then history started again. So we got both capitalist hegemony, techno-capital, which is a very, very, very weak phrase for what we're dealing with. It's not the right phrase. It's the best phrase we have, but we're dealing with something. And then the commodification of identity itself is something that very few people could have predicted. And one final thing I'll say about this is we can talk about all the great thinkers through all the centuries. They could not have predicted America right now.
No.
Nobody could have predicted this right now. Nobody saw this coming to the degree, the scale, and it's happened in our lifetimes. So yeah, we're all, if you're not squirming, I want whatever you're taking. I want it. Just give it to me. You know, send me to your pharmacist.
Right.
Okay. That's what I have to say about that.
No,
it's very hard to imagine Bill. Yeah, and it's hard to imagine Bill like if he got fat and like, ended up doing casinos. Like that could have happened too, right? So we got to be careful. You don't want to, you know, or he could have moved to the UK, but then ended up hating it, or who knows? Imagine Bill Hicks on like the Doug Stanhope podcast right now, right. Like what that would sound like. Like, I don't right. know. Hard right. to imagine, you know, does he stay sober? It's, yeah. you know, yeah.
yeah. Yeah. Yeah, this is all great. I mean, I was kind of thinking about this question today as I was listening to Relentless, and, you know, sort of trying to transplant the same just sort of overall perspective, but into like current day. And again, I'm not going to get in the object level here, but he's talking a lot about the first Gulf War in that special, right? And you think about that attitude he had on it, very anti-war, very like, what is the point of all of this? Like, this is, you know, all of the very, you know, I think things that a lot of people subscribe to. If you take that and you transplant it into today and the conflicts that we've got going on now, I think he would ruffle a lot of feathers all over the place of people who would have agreed with him in the early, you know what I mean? Like, there would be a lot of like, well, wait, what is he talking about? Is he not, you know, is he not on the same side of this thing as I am? And I just,
but he was a Christopher Hitchens, you know?
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just, yeah. It's hard to say where he'd land. I mean, part of when you ask this question, I think part of it is, well, whose propaganda does he fall for? Because we all fell for somebody's, right? That's sort of, right. you know, what part of the YouTube algorithm snatched him up is sort of what this question might devolve down into. But I do like this. Well, I don't like it, but I think you're very right that there'd be something about seeing him squirm that would be a little soul crushing to watch, because there would be something about Bill Hicks squirming that would, you'd sort of think, man, if he can't get out of this without squirming, what chance do I have? You know, like who can get through it without squirming then? Yeah.
Yeah. I really, we're never going to have it. And I don't know how appropriate any of this is, but whatever. Like, I really wonder what a Bill Hicks who, really got immersed at length in the UK and saw that culture for what it is. I wonder what he would have to say. Because there's always a honeymoon, you know, you go abroad, you see a different country, and you're coming from frickin', you know, Houston, Texas or whatever. Yeah, there's London in the UK seems shiny and different. But I really wonder what his insights would have been if he had continued touring over there. Just one thing we'll never know. Yeah. Brad, you mentioned that you watched one of their early movies that he made Kevin Booth?
Yeah, yeah. With Kevin Booth and Dwight Slade. Yeah, the Ninja Bachelor Party, which you can just find, which is just a funny title in and of itself, you can find on YouTube. And I was sort of telling you guys before we started recording that it's not, you know, brilliant by any means, but it is actually pretty funny. And just the setup is like a Bill Hicks type character. He's like a teenager. He tells his very straight-laced Texas parents that he has made the career choice. Despite his Robitussin addiction, he is going to become a ninja warrior in the 1980s suburban Texas.
And despite a Robitussin addiction? Okay.
Yes, yes. And there's these great little bits because his dad starts to explain to him why it's a bad career move based on statistics that are apparently in the newspaper about becoming, like, there's very like surreal moments like this. He's like, you know, the ninja warriors are down 2% since last year in the stock market or whatever. And what I liked about it is you could see all of the sensibilities. You could see all the Bill Hicks kind of sensibilities, but much more. I mean, it's juvenilia. It's basically a stand-up comics juvenilia, which you don't often get to see. So if you're like a Bill Hicks maximalist, I think you really owe it to yourself to go. It's a 25 minutes or 28 minutes. You owe it to yourself to go see this because it is like, you can see the germ, and he's gonna refine all of this stuff. All the stuff that's in there is getting sharp, gets sharpened down into, you know, the later razor blade that is Bill Hicks stand up. So I had quite a good time.
You know, ninjas used memory techniques.
Did they?
Oh,
interesting. Yeah. Well, let's do, we're getting close to the end of our hour. One thing we are going to do in the After Dark is we're going to have the memory, we have the Magnetic Memory Master here with us in the Art of Darkness Studios. We'd be foolish not to take advantage of this. We're going to have Anthony give us, well, I don't even know how to describe it. You're going to share with us some of the method or a method. What would be the best way to describe that?
I will go as deep down the rabbit hole as you wish to go. There are thousands of years of tradition to memory techniques, and there's kind of two worlds. There's the memory competition world.
Mm-hmm.
I've done okay there. And then there's the world of applying it to long-term absorption of really complicated stuff. And
interesting.
So we can talk about both those things. But at the end of the day, if ninjas do it and Bill Hicks did it,
it works, right?
And I think that part of Bill Hicks's enlightenment, I believe, is from the repetition of certain things from memory.
Sure.
It's very common amongst people who repeat things from memory a lot that they have some kind of awakening as a
interesting.
That's connected to that. It's a thesis, a theory, but
it makes sense to me. Yeah.
It makes sense to me too. I can imagine if you perform Hamlet 50 times, you're going to come away. Yeah, you're going to come away.
Well, it becomes something a lot more than something on paper that you're reading, right? I mean, it already is, but even more so. Anthony, as we kind of wind down, I do want to ask this question. I kind of meant to do it earlier, but I'm very interested in it. What was your sort of entry point to this memory stuff? What got you? I mean, there's a general appeal. Everybody wants to have a better memory, but what made you? What drew you into it? How did you get into it?
I wish everybody wanted to have a better memory.
Some of us want to forget, frankly.
The marketing would be done.
Right. There you go. Yeah.
I got into it, to dwell on that morbid topic. I was in university.
Hmm.
I started my PhD. I had field exams looming, and I was really stressed out about them because I had gone through a clinical depression that led to hospitalization. Oh. And I was one of these people who was hell bent on science must have the answer. You know, so I took the pills, I went to the therapy sessions, I did all that stuff, but I couldn't focus and concentrate. And I was drooling out of one side of my mouth all the time because I was that medicated. Turns out that really I just should have drank coffee, but for whatever reason, I didn't. I'm sort of shortening a story that's in the Victorious Mind that you graciously mentioned at the beginning. But coffee really did help me, and I don't take medication at all anymore.
Wow, interesting.
So bizarre. But anyway, okay. I was at the point of dropping out of university, and one day a letter came from the government saying that my student loans were going to come due sooner than they were expecting because the administration has made some decision, whatever. So then I thought, well, I'm going to go and jump off the bridge. I ended up not doing that. And I went to university that day anyway. And at York University in Toronto, there's a place called York Lanes. It's like it tries to imitate like an outdoor New York street or something inside because Canada is obsessively and oppressively cold. And these people, like David Blaine is the big thing at the time. And these people are doing street magic in this fake inside street. And suddenly something just dawns in my mind. And I go, I know magic. I grab the guy's cards from his hands. I do a magic trick for him. And I haven't done a magic trick since like elementary school or whatever. But I somehow pull it off. I remembered it. I go home and I suddenly find on YouTube all of the, and YouTube's just a new thing. And everything is free, you know, like everything. And I'm watching all these guys do these card tricks and stuff like this. And the idea of what's called the Holy Grail in magic, any card at any number comes up. And really to do it well, you have to be able to memorize a deck of cards and know where all the cards are. So I was like, this is impossible. I can't even read this bizarre French critical theory that I'm supposed to be doing. How am I going to memorize a deck of cards? But something just pulled me to try it. And lo and behold, I memorized the deck of cards. And I thought, my God, if I can get all this bizarre theory, like terms like architectonic tautology on these cards, I could do the same thing. And I started to feel better. And I thought, this is so weird. And I never really thought that much about the feeling better, but I kept feeling better. And better the more that I did this. maybe 15 years later, I read this research by a guy named Tim Dauglish, and he, with his research team, they're using the Memory Palace technique that I've used for the playing cards and that I use for lots of things with people who have PTSD and depression. And lo and behold, these people, they're dealing better with PTSD. They're dealing with depression better. So I'm just like, what the heck? This is not my confirmation bias. This is a fully embedded, you know, peer-reviewed article, and there's more of them. So it's just memory techniques saved my life. Like, they literally saved my life.
Wow.
And I didn't start a business around it for, I don't know, 12 years or something like that, because I finished my PhD. I actually won a Mercator research grant, and I wound up in Germany. And then they were like, hey, any chance you could like lecture in German? And I was like, how much time are you going to give me? And they're like, well, it'd be great if you could do it in March. And, you know, it's January or something. So I'm like, okay, in for a penny, in for a pound. So I just started memorizing all this German. And I gave my first lecture on time in German at that time. And I just kept on going and going. And it's totally an accident that I wrote a book about memory techniques. And it's just, long story short, some students said, how are you doing this? And I said, oh, like this. And I got them to recite the alphabet backwards, just a really simple thing. And then I taught them some other stuff, and they said, hey, could you write that down? And I was like, hell yeah. And then like the Kindle Goldmine stuff was happening at the time. So a friend of mine was like, dude, you got to put that up on Amazon. So I did. Right. And I forgot about it. And then 2 weeks later, he's like, man, have you seen your book? And I was like, nope. So I go and look, and it's like number one in two categories, number three in another category. Wow. And I'm just thinking, damn. So
there might be something here. Interesting.
You mentioned more books than you could count. Well, that's why.
Yeah. Wow. So, hey, you know, you're a shaman, you know, like this is,
but this not by choice.
Maybe it's never by choice. That's the thing. I think in some cultures, you know, some cultures, the shaman is the person who is the, what do they call it? In some cultures, it translates to the half-healed madman. You know, there's a little bit of that. It's like you go someplace and you heal yourself back, and it's you know, you bring something into people's lives, right? Fascinating. Yeah. Well, I'm glad I asked that question, because what a story. That's amazing. And we're so glad you found your way out of it and the way that you did. Amazing.
Yeah, I'm sometimes glad too.
sure. Well, you know, Kevin, I don't know if you've got anything else, any Bill Hicks stuff you want to chat about, or we can kind of.
We've got more time on the After Dark for patrons. Indeed, and people can patronize the pod through Patreon or through Substack. They are completely equal. You can find all the links at artofdarkpod.com. Anthony, I really enjoyed this. I like that we just go right to the deep end. Learn to swim. Yeah. Here we go.
Great.
Sink or swim with Anthony.
Well, we're talking about Bill Hicks. Really cool. Definitely got to learn how to swim.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And we'll have links in the show notes to everything Anthony is doing. Again, more books than you can count. Amazing YouTube channel. If you're at all interested in this stuff, that is the place to go. I mean, he has got an unbelievable amount of, I kind of hate the word content, but I don't know what else to put, videos, discussions about different memory techniques, all sorts of stuff. So please check that out as well.
Yeah. And on the After Dark, we're going to talk about the tool Bill Hicks connection, and then Anthony's going to give us a memory lesson. So you're not going to want to miss that. Fantastic. Good stuff. I got Fitzgerald coming. Brad, you've got
Flannery O'Connor in a couple days.
Flannery O'Connor. Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. All right. We'll be back. If you can remember, patreon.com/artofdarkpod.
Yeah.
Plant that right into your memory. Yeah, or Substack. And then just move back and forth and just tell it yourself to yourself 1,000 times. And that is marketing. But don't kill yourself.
By now, you're feeling that it's, you deserve this. You know, you worked hard. By now, you totally realize that this is the moment to really get involved in a deeper way to support the people who, you know, you love and admire, and you're doing hard work for you, because by now, and on and on.
Yeah. I love it. I love it.
Yeah, I do it better by now.
So. That was great. That was great.